Immersive cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Freshly prepared regional cuisine. Viking sails the rivers of the world and takes travelers to the heart of iconic destinations. Discover more at viking.com.
Ned Despard is put on trial for trumped-up treason charges, and things are looking pretty grim.
I served with Colonel Despard as army surgeon during the American War. During that campaign, he sustained a number of serious head injuries, subsequent to tropical fevers and further cerebral wounds, all sustained in the service of the Crown, have taken their toll. And I believe that permanent and irreversible brain damage has occurred.
Despite Ross and Dwight's best efforts, it's death for the rebellious colonel. And even with Ned's noble last-minute speechifying, he's hanged for treason, leaving Ross and Kitty bereft.
I hope that falsehood, greed, tyranny will be vanquished. This nation, which I have loved, will one day be a beacon of democracy, freedom, justice, and humanity.
And Geoffrey, Charles, and Cecily desperately try to escape Sir George's marital clutches, only to realize the easiest solution is right in front of them.
I wish to declare that it's barely a day since I gave myself, body and soul, to Geoffrey Charles Francis Poldark.
So if you wed her, you will always wonder, is her first child mine or yours?
I'm Barrett Brontës, and this is Mining Poldark, a podcast from Masterpiece. For this sixth episode of the final season of Poldark, I'm thrilled to turn to an exclusive interview I had with Andrew Graham, the son of Poldark novelist Winston Graham. We spoke about his father's legacy, the enduring magic of Cornwall, and how series creator Debbie Horsfield used Winston's words in the novels still to come to shape this fifth and final season. I'm pleased to be joined by Andrew Graham, son of Poldark author Winston Graham. Andrew, welcome.
Very nice to hear you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So let's jump right in. The time jump between The Angry Tide and The Stranger from the Sea is 11 years. And during this fifth season, Debbie Horsfield's original effort attempts to bridge that gap. How do you think your father would have responded to the plot lines this season?
I think to answer that, I think I have to go back a step and think a little bit about how I, from the viewpoint of the literary estate, had to think about it. Because I think that probably, you know, my father's not alive, so I couldn't ask him. But I had to try and ask the question that you've just asked, really of myself. And what it seemed to us was that there's quite a lot that's already in place. I mean, if you start with The Stranger from the Sea and the subsequent novels, a variety of things happen which make it impossible for other things to take place in the earlier period. You know, some people are alive, some people are dead, and that fixes certain things. And then you go back to the end of The Angry Tide and the very tragic, awful death of Elizabeth. And there's a set of things that are in train from that as well. And then there are one or two extra clues. My father wrote things about what was happening to Ross and Demelza in The Stranger from the Sea. And so that pins things down. So you've got things coming forwards from The Angry Tide, things coming backwards from The Stranger from the Sea. And then in the middle of all this is something which I think my father would have been incredibly keen on, and which I think Debbie Horsfield has treated really beautifully, which is the actual historical events. I mean, my father did extraordinary research for the novels, and Debbie has done the same. So a lot of the things that happen in the novels are based on real events, real characters.
Mm. May I introduce my battlefield saviour and your husband's most esteemed surgeon, Dr. Dwight Ennis. This is Catherine Despard.
I'm honoured to meet you, sir.
The honour is entirely mine, ma'am.
Knowing your husband, you're already assured of my admiration.
And I think that those, that three-way pin down, if I can put it like that, would have made my father feel that if anybody could have pulled this off, Debbie had succeeded.
And so was history a particular interest of your father's? And how do you think he came to begin including historical events in The Stranger from the Sea onwards, where he hadn't really had so much historical figures in the earlier books?
I think the in his mind, there wouldn't have been the disjunction that you've implied, because I think what happened was before he ever wrote a Poldark, he'd written about another 8, 9, 10 novels. And I think what happened was he was then in the Second World War as a Coast Guard. And he was sitting there meeting people from Cornwall and really engaging in conversation with him. And the cliffs around him, where this Coast Guard hut was located, they had the old mine workings. And I think there was a combination of him beginning to be interested in the surroundings and the people telling him about what had happened in the past. And that's where his passion for the history began. And so in all those early novels, the first four that he published, there's absolutely accurate accounts of what happens with the emergence of banking in this period, the what's happening to the fishing, what's happening to the mining, what's happening to the landscape and the farming and the rise of new money. So he had already done all that historical research. And indeed, I think, you know, some of the figures who appear, some of the banking figures, they are real people in Cornwall at that time. And so when it carries on in the subsequent books, in The Stranger from the Sea and afterwards, the final novel goes all the way through to Waterloo. And there are real figures. But I don't think it was any separation between the historical authenticity of the earlier books and the historical authenticity of the later books.
I find it fascinating that there he was serving during the war in Cornwall at this moment where the world is shifting, and that's the time of Genesis, really, or right after the war, of Poldark, where there are also, you know, real shifts. There's the spirit of that coming through, that moment in history that he was living in, must have somehow impacted the series.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there was a sense in Britain at the second, and during the, and after the Second World War, that they just really didn't want to return to what had been happening in the 20s and 30s. And so there was a kind of optimism. And my father says somewhere that if, in general, his writing seems more touched by the milk of human kindness than by death and destruction, it's because he feels that he had a life which, on the whole, was optimistic and moving in the right direction. And that then comes through into the novels. And I think that's what part of their great appeal. I mean, it's not as if there aren't some really tough, nasty people and some really awful things that happen, and people are very ill and a lot of people die and the people are caught in these incredibly difficult circumstances. But deep down, people, I think, can read the novels and have a sense of hope. I mean, Ross and Demelza, they keep going. They have a sense of integrity about themselves. Even George Warlegan, this really disagreeable, mean, avaricious banker, is obviously incredibly cut up by the death of Elizabeth, and it's clear that he really loved her. And you can feel a sense of engagement with George. And I think that, you know, I'm very objective about my father's writing, but I think that when the bad guys are also people you can like, you know that the writing's going well.
That is exactly what I find with George, and often so angry at myself for sympathizing with him so intensely. You've mentioned in a previous interview that your father wrote a letter in October 1980 when he began writing The Stranger from the Sea, and that he, quote, felt stirrings again after 4 years, and then he spent the rest of his life writing Poldark novels in 1981, 82, 84, 1990, and 2002, just a year before his passing. So obviously his career extends far beyond Poldark. But was Poldark the central story of his life?
I think I want to rather surprisingly say no. I think Poldark and Cornwall and my mother were probably the three great loves of his life. But they weren't, Poldark wasn't the center of his life because, I mean, amazingly, he wrote 12 Poldark novels, but he probably wrote another 30 novels. And I think that my father was essentially someone who was a storyteller. And he was deeply, deeply unhappy when he wasn't writing. And, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, late on in his life, he returned to writing the Poldarks and wrote a great many. But in that later period in his life, exactly as in the earlier period of his life, he interspersed the Poldarks with other novels. I mean, he wrote a book called Stephanie in 1992, Tremor in 1995, The Ugly Sister in 1998. So all the time he keeps coming back to Poldark, sometimes with very, very long lags, and because that family is there and they keep ticking away in his head. But he's a writer. He's a writer. That's what really drove him.
Now, your sister, Rosamund, has said that Demelza was partly based on your mother, Jean Williamson, and that your mother, as she said, helped with the details because she was so observant.
Friends, on behalf of Captain Poldark, who sadly can't be with us here today, but who has gifted us this land for the building of our school, it gave me pleasure to lay the first stone and to ask a blessing on our mission, which is to bring knowledge and learning to all.
What was their literary relationship like between your parents? And what did her sort of observation of detail look like? How did that play out?
I think it's probably difficult to overestimate the impact of my mother on all of this. She was the only person with whom he really talked over his novels. He said on one occasion to me that he would never tell anybody the story of a novel because then he'd lost the impetus to tell it. But he told it to my mother. And much, much more than that, my mother would see little things in newspapers and draw them to his attention and say, Winston, what about that? So my mother was prodding him. And in that sense, she's very like Demelza. She always wants to be...
I was thinking that.
Yeah, she wants to be... She's saying to my father, do this. What about this? What about this?
And where are you recognised?
I don't think so. It's too far away.
Let's round up a parcel of men and head straight for Jackers.
No, I think we should wait. Still no clue what they're up to.
Whether it is our or they're shipping away.
And what else could it be?
I have no wish to confront them without just cause. It's better to watch and wait.
And catch them in the act.
Agree. So, you give them no sign, we suspect them.
Well, especially not that one.
That's if she's involved, and so far, there's no proof of it.
And then, as Rosamund, my sister, has absolutely correctly said, she would spot whether someone had changed their dress, whether the picture on the wall wasn't quite straight, whether the colour of the fabric didn't match another bit of fabric, what had they eaten for lunch.
Wow.
So all of those little tiny details.
It all comes together to create such a world, not just the characters, but the world building is a huge part of the appeal.
Absolutely. The other thing which I didn't really think about this when I was a young person reading the novels, and I'm not sure that everybody thinks about it now, but the significance of locating the books in Cornwall with the rise of banking and the rise of mining is that in the late 18th century, Cornwall was absolutely at the forefront of the Industrial Revolution. That's why the new banks were being set up. That's why people were making money. That's why people were beginning to make steam engines. And so
Amazing. It
wasn't just a lost southwest corner at the tip of England. It was a very vibrant part of the country. And I think that adds to the sense of the history and why there's a battle between old money and new money and between the classes, and because it was where the social fabric was under pressure at the time.
Let's hold on for a second and take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors.
Coming up next on Masterpiece on PBS, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office continues Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, followed by the finale of Alice and Jack at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central.
I've been lucky enough to have co-hosted this podcast with Robin Ellis, who played Ross in the original 1970s adaptation of your father's novels.
Yes.
I understand that your father wasn't such a big fan of the first season of the show, but I also understand that he came to really cherish Robin's work and that they even became very good friends.
My father's annoyance with the first series by the BBC was nothing to do with Robin or Anne Harrod mm-hmm. or any of the key actors. It was simply that he had done this deal with the BBC and he trusted the BBC and he actually knew the person whom they were going to be using as the scriptwriter. But when the script of the first episode appeared, my father, he had a pretty strong temper, my father, and it absolutely hit the roof because they had changed the character of Demelza and made her look mm-hmm. like a cheap woman trying to take her knickers off at the drop of a hat. And so my father actually tried to cancel the whole contract. But luckily for him and luckily for us, that wasn't successful.
Did sort of they take his feedback and change it, or did they say, hang on, next week she's the Demelza you know and love? Like, how did
they changed it a little bit, but nothing like enough. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the things that has been so beautiful and so pleasing about the second adaptation that Mammoth Screen have done is that they captured the Ross Demelza relationship exactly as it is in the books. I think the whole seduction scene between Ross and Demelza is exactly as it is.
What is it?
The dress. It unfastens down the back.
You know what people say of us. If we behave like this, it will be true.
Then let it be true.
One or two people, by the way, being very, very observant, have said in the novel and in the TV series exactly the same, she says, I can't undo the buttons, the hooks on the back mm-hmm. of my frock.
On the back.
And mm-hmm. some people have written in saying, but in those days, frocks were done up at the front. Now,
right.
So I think that's one bit of artistic license that my father allowed himself. He probably knew they were done up at the front, but he just thought in terms of the depiction of the scene, it needs to be at the back.
He was right. It's perfect. Now, obviously, the Poldark story continues well beyond this final season, almost 20 years, in fact. So can you offer our listeners a preview of where Ross and Demelza and all their friends end up in the next two decades? Little teaser?
I think not. I've read the books. I mean, I could say this happens and this happens and this happens. What I would prefer to say is that I'm sure you know that I may not quote the exact line, but there's a line at the beginning of Anna Karenina when it says something like, all happy families are happy in the same way. All unhappy yes. families are unhappy in their own way. And what I think my father felt he was doing, particularly as the Poldarks went on and then on again, he was trying to write something that he thought was actually really difficult. He was trying to write the story of a marriage that continues and is ultimately together and happy, despite all its tensions and the frictions between Demelza and Ross. This isn't a boring happiness. This is an interesting, alive happiness. And I think, you know, you referred to the letter that I got from this woman who was a fan, and I think my father said the Poldarks will never end because it will never have a tidy ending and the Pollocks will never end because life's not like that. But he really engaged with Ross and Demelza and their children living out their life with all the difficulties that we all face when we're realistic about it and yet going on loving each other.
I think you sense that in the series thus far. So I love that continues because there's so much truth in it. There's a long marriage. It can be something like a dance where they come together and then they move apart and come together in a new way.
Absolutely.
And so it's beautiful. And I think that, you know, with all the swashbuckling and adventure and derring do, at its heart is this marriage between these two very specific, really wonderful, complicated characters and the way they grow together.
Absolutely.
Judas, I never thought that... Ned. Poor Kitty. And you? What would it mean for you that your friend was declared traitor? Would your good name suffer?
Do I care?
Not now, perhaps, but...
If I never see London again, it'll be too soon.
Did you weep? When he died?
What good would it have done?
You should not stopper up tears, Ross. You should weep for him. For the better part of him. It is the better part of you.
Do you have a favorite Poldark memory, either from the books or from your own experience in the world of Poldark, from your family? Is there any one memory that you have that is your favorite?
I'm not big on one moment. I think life's too rich to be captured in a single moment. But I could pick out two or three. There's a totally spectacular shot of when Demelza is really cross with Ross, has gone down onto the beach, dressed in a long red dress, and is walking through the white surf. Oh, fantastic. Just incredible. Yeah. The sense of frustration, annoyance, and the beauty of the world around her and everything. That's an amazing moment. I mean, I think the other thing which you asked me what goes on in the later novels, and one thing I would be willing to say is the enmity, the really deep enmity between Ross and George, that continues. And I think that drives the novels right through to the very end. And what reminded me of that is the scene on the beach when Ross and George confront each other.
Well, Ross, my compliments to the volunteers. I believe they were put to good use today. Oh, did you think you were being summoned to fight the Frenchies? No, it seems Tom Harry got the better of you. A little nudge and your muskets protect my grain store. But you humble foot soldiers must go where your betters decree, I believe.
What else do you believe, George?
I believe I have every reason for optimism. I believe I have a devoted wife, a thriving son, a fine estate, and a parliamentary career which has barely begun. What is it you believe, Ross?
That belief is a beautiful thing.
And it's just a great, great line.
It's so loaded because at this moment, is he realizing that he believed in his marriage? Is it too late?
Yes.
You know,
yes.
There's so many things that he could be saying at that moment.
Absolutely.
Oh.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah. That's fantastic. It's really one of the best of all. Andrew Graham, it's been such a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much for bringing your insights and your wonderful stories to our viewers and our listeners. We're very grateful. And for all your work bringing this story back to our screens. Well, Thank you so much.
An enormous fan of PBS. The world at the moment needs organizations like PBS and the BBC far, far more than they ever did in the past. So please keep going.
That was Andrew Graham, son of Poldark creator Winston Graham, in a conversation with me, of course. Coming up on our penultimate episode ever, Detective Demelza uncovers some troubling news.
This weapons hoard, though, is it not some strange French smugglers?
The French spies.
You think? What could they intend?
An invasion?
We'll investigate with her next time. And you can join us in our rewatching adventure here on Mining Poldark by watching the entire series on PBS Passport, a new member benefit from your local PBS station. You can watch select Masterpiece titles like Poldark, Downton Abbey, or Victoria as part of the Passport experience. To learn more, visit pbs.org/getpassport. You can also follow along with us on the PBS Masterpiece Prime video channel, available as an add-on service to your Amazon Prime membership. Mining Poldark is hosted by me, Barrett Brontes, and Robin Ellis. We're produced by Nick Anderson with help from Robin Bissett. Meredith Wheeler is our field producer. Tina Toby Mack is our sound designer. Suzanne Simpson is our executive producer. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Rebecca Eaton. Sponsors for Masterpiece on PBS are Viking, Raymond James, and the Masterpiece Trust. Poldark is a Mammoth Screen production for BBC, co-produced with Masterpiece.
Masterpiece Studio is officially a Webby Awards nominee for 2024. We are honored to be considered among such talented competition, but we need your vote. Head over to vote.webbyawards.com and vote for Masterpiece Studio in the podcast section, where you'll find us listed in the general television and film category. Voting closes Thursday, April 18th, so be sure to get your vote in soon. That's vote.webbyawards.com. Thank you.